Welcome back. It's the Kaufman Show. I'm Dave Kaufman. This is TSN Radio. This is your favorite radio show. And if it isn't yet, give us a couple hours. We might manage to sway you. I am Dave, joined tonight by Marco Polo on the board. Hello, Marco.
Sup.
How are you, sir?
All right, you?
I'm great, man. I'm great. I'm having another wonderfully busy week. Try to figure out the time. I'm wondering if I should use these 2 hours to see if anybody has Oceaga tickets to sell me for Saturday night.
Oh, you should just show up. You'll
Yeah, you don't think there'll be a problem?
Yeah.
Tickets are going for roughly three times their face value right now.
What's up with selling out? That didn't used to happen in earlier editions of Oceaga.
No, it didn't.
Because there's only one way in and one way out? Is that it? Or it's an outdoor concert?
Yeah, but there's only a finite amount of space and only so many porta-potties.
Too many people.
I think they cap it at about 40,000 a day. And yeah, I was a little late on it this year. And look at that, it's sold out. But I want to go see Beck on Saturday night. I think that would be an awesome show. I saw Beck at the Bell Center, God, 6-7 years ago. And it was just, he's a great performer. And
okay.
I think that would be worth the price of admission alone, as long as the price isn't ridiculous. They're selling the tickets now for the price of the three-day ticket.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of intense.
Well, just wait around. You'll get some desperate brokers.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I've got another job from 10 to 6 on Saturday. So I'm thinking I'll just show up at 6 o'clock. And,
yeah, what time does Beck go on?
Probably the last of the night. I think he's probably 10 o'clock.
He's a headliner, so yeah, just wait it out.
I will wait it out. And in the meantime, I'm loving this title of the coordinator of special events for Expos Nation, Matthew Ross, the head honcho, El Capitan of Expos Nation, the host of Game Points Radio on Sundays and Tuesdays on TSN 690. He bestowed this title upon me. So, you know, I had to call the cops yesterday to make sure that everything was cool for our event on the 17th. We're playing catch on the 17th in the morning at Jerry Park. It's going to be a lot of fun. I know a lot of TSN 690, celebrities are going to be there. And perhaps a little bit more exciting than that is you'll have a chance to play catch with guys like Derek O'Quinn and Steve Rogers. Rumor is Claude Raymond may show up. So there's going to be some really cool people for you to play catch with, and we're going to be adding even more names to this season ticket list. Have you heard about this, Marco?
No, but I am intrigued. Do you have to alert the authorities now if you want to play baseball? Is that how bad it's gotten in the city?
You know, after last year's student protests, any time that a group is congregating, you just have to cross the T's and dot the I's and just make sure. And the answer I got back was, as long as you're not marching through the streets singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, it shouldn't be too much of a problem.
Keep your pots and pans at home.
Could you imagine Expos fans menifing through the streets?
They'd have to bring portable chairs that they can bang really hard, like they used to do with the Big O.
And the vuvuzelas.
Right.
It wasn't a vuvuzela, but it was essentially the Quebecois equivalent, I'd say.
Yeah, they're in minor hockey arenas everywhere.
Oh, that's a good impression. Wow. You can impersonate an idiot really easily. That's awesome.
I play one on the radio.
Go to exposnation.com and check out this new initiative. We are trying to get people to sign up for season tickets. And we have different price ranges. And basically, you put down what you would be interested in signing up for should there be a baseball team. And it's to give one day a prospective owner the idea that, yeah, there's people behind this. And I think it's right now, in the 24 hours it's been up, over 4,000 people have committed to season tickets already. So just going to pat myself on the back there. No, I think it's great. I'm really happy to see. Yeah. Again, not me, but Expos Nation. And Matthew Ross has done so much. And really, the committee is awesome. Derek O'Quinn is now on the committee for Expos Nation. And people are excited. It's so nice for the first time in 9 years to hear people say the words baseball in Montreal and not follow it by like spitting. It's so damn refreshing.
I guess it took a while, eh? For the wounds to heal before people could move on.
It
people
seems
bitter
so.
For so long.
It seems that way. That it took a long time for that bitterness to subside. And you know, I think the hope right now is that if the people can mobilize, they can hopefully show an eventual Daddy Warbucks down the road that this is a viable option, that this is the largest market in North America that doesn't have Major League Baseball. And that's money. They can sell TV rights in two languages.
Yeah, but would it be a slam dunk? Let's say the Tampa Bay Rays, we learn tomorrow, they're up for grabs, they're going to move. Would like Indianapolis compete? Buffalo, other cities? Would it just be a slam dunk? They're going to Montreal. There's nowhere else they could go.
No, the other argument would be Portland. Austin, Texas would be another one. Those are the ones with the largest markets. But Montreal is the largest market. So it's tough to want to move somewhere that's smaller, that doesn't have the opportunities that Montreal has. There are 4 million people here. There are two networks, including one that we work for, that would kill for the content that a baseball team provides. Can you imagine if Bell had a baseball team and they were competing with Rogers?
That's a great point. Who made it? I think it was Bruce Arthur the first day that Melnick was in Toronto.
Uh-huh.
He made that point. Like, Rogers has their baseball team. TSN does not have theirs. So if you can get those dollars, I think it was Anakin Slade who asked, where's the money going to come from one day on this station?
Mm-hmm.
And I would respond that it could be media money. It could be the people who pay us working here right now at the station. They might be willing to fork over the dough to get the content. They have the vehicle. They have, you know what I mean, the mobile devices, the TVs in every home.
They're one of the few that could afford it, Marco.
Yeah, yeah. And we see emerging now of content and provider. Like, a lot of media companies are getting into owning sports franchises. And I think it would be, like you said, a slam dunk for Bell to get involved in trying to attract the baseball team to come here.
We'll go back to this a little bit later in the show. We're going to be taking a break right now, and then we're going to be joined by Dave Zirin, who had a huge article in Grantland.com today, the ESPN website, about Sochi and the potential boycott. And basically, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. But we'll get back to our Expos Nation talk. Tampa Bay, not necessarily a slam dunk. If they were up for sale tomorrow, there'd be that whole issue of a stadium. And, yeah, that's still the big one. That's still the big one. As many people have mentioned, the thought of going back to that, I will steal from The Simpsons, urine-soaked heck hole that they call the Olympic Stadium.
It's not safe right now. Who knows if they can even have another CFL game in there or an MLS game with the problems they're having structurally there. But have you walked around the McGill Basin where they're proposing maybe building a ballpark?
The Peel Basin where all the condos are going up. Yeah, I have a better spot.
Really?
I have a better spot.
I would love to hear it on the other side of the break.
We'll get into it on The Kaufman Show. Welcome back to The Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman here with you. Marco Polo on the board. John Kakalakis is helping us out. And we're about to be joined by one of my favorite all-time guests from The Kaufman Show. He is the sports editor for The Nation. You can see him on ESPN. You can read him in The New York Times. You can read him at Deadspin. And today, you can read him on Grantland.com. He wrote an article that doesn't normally get the type of play on Grantland.com that you would expect. They're usually reviewing Mad Men and Jonah Carey cracking Simpsons jokes and writing baseball analysis. But today they went a step deeper, and Lord knows I was happy to see it. Let's welcome Dave Zirin back to the show. Hello, Dave.
Hey, great to be here, Kaufman. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Anytime. Really happy to see your article today on Grantland. I thought it was awesome that you tackled this Sochi boycott issue.
Well, it's because, to me, there are very good people making very different arguments, people who want the same things, people who want to see a Russia that doesn't criminalize people for being gay, a Russia that doesn't throw people in prison for saying that they think there should be gay rights, a Russia that doesn't throw tourists in prison who said they think there should be gay rights. Like, if you went to Russia right now and said, I think there should be gay rights, they can put you in jail for 2 weeks, according to their new decrees. And that would mean, as I put in the article, that the Pope, based on his recent statements, could be arrested by Putin's government for some of the things he said. So there are people who want to see action taken. There are people who don't want Putin using the Olympics without being challenged for his own prestige. Some people are saying boycott. Other people are saying maybe we should try a different strategy.
Now, Patrick Burke, very famously from You Can Play, came out last week and said there should not be an athlete boycott. And I think you're in the same corner as that, that there are better ways to make this happen, better ways to show Russia what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah, and to be clear, the position that Patrick have and I have, and we are simpatico on this, and you did a terrific interview with Patrick on this, by the way.
Thank you.
Is the big difference is this isn't the same as what, for example, Johnny Weir is saying. Johnny Weir is a openly gay figure skater, of course. And Johnny Weir has said, no boycott. If we're out there and we show our excellence on the field, that will be a spit in the eye to Putin, and that's what it's all about, because the Olympics really aren't about politics. This isn't Putin's time, it's our time. And that sounds good, but it's just not the truth.
No.
I mean, it's just not true. I mean, we could say all we want that the Olympics are about sports, they're about the athletes, the country is just the host, but it's just not true.
Now, anybody who's ever seen an opening ceremonies, Dave, I think, you know, the idolization of a country that you see going on in an opening ceremonies.
Exactly, and then you have to think, well, who benefits from that idolization? It's who's ever in power, it's whoever made the bids, it's whoever made the payoffs. And that, of course, has the attendant effect. Take a place like Sochi, which is $30 billion over budget in terms of making the Olympics happen. It's a way of saying to the whole country, hey, look, it was all worth it. It was all worth it. So it's an amazingly political moment, though, not just the opening ceremonies, but the entire games. And so there needs to be something. And so instead of the Jesse Owens approach, let's call what Johnny Weir is saying the Jesse Owens approach, mm-hmm. you know, just going, just like Owens went to Hitler's Berlin in 36 and was excellent, which was not a small thing, certainly, but instead more of a John Carlos and Tommy Smith approach, which is using the platform to actually make a statement. To basically what people would be doing would be daring Putin to arrest them.
Which, you know, for an athlete isn't going to happen. But I think members of the media, I think that fans showing up, I think everybody, you know, the lover of an athlete going there to support their partner, we're leading ourselves down a very, very rosy garden path if we think that there aren't going to be problems.
You know, it's interesting, though, what you just said, I think, is absolutely correct, which is they wouldn't dare arrest an athlete for such a thing during the Olympics. But even if they don't dare arrest an athlete, that would be a huge deal for Russia's domestic politics, because one of the leading members of their parliament said this week, the co-writer of the bill that basically criminalizes gay life in Russia, the co-writer of the bill said they would arrest people. They would arrest any athlete who does anything that violates the law. I don't think that's going to happen. But when they don't arrest an athlete for speaking out, all of a sudden this lawmaker, his name is Milanov, he's very powerful in Russia, all of a sudden he looks like a horse's patootie, and that's a good thing.
Dave, we saw, of course, the you know, Summer Olympics in Beijing in 2008, and we've seen countries that we don't necessarily agree with host Olympics before, and frankly, more and more that we see what a financial boondoggle the Olympics are, the less westernized countries seem to be applying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but some of that is also, that's the IOC, because the IOC wants to be able to have a place where not only they can have financial boondoggles, and global growth economically is happening much more in these BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, than it is in Western Europe, the United States, Canada. Growth has been much more sluggish there. But also they want countries that can put forward the kind of security apparatus and, if necessary, put down protests with extreme prejudice. We certainly did see that in China in 2008. It's an open question to me whether we're going to see it in Brazil. And I think in Sochi, Vladimir Putin has shown that he is willing to do just that, which once again makes the fact that people are already calling marches to coincide with the opening ceremonies, it makes already we're seeing courageous political acts.
I think that the fact that China owns half the world's debt prevented people from speaking out in a proper way in 2008. And I think that a lot of the detractors from a lot of people who are saying that something shouldn't be done, that this is just the way it is and it's how it should be, point to China and the lack of action there.
Yeah, but what's interesting, too, is I totally put so much of that on the IOC, about as corrupt a body as you can imagine, as long as you're not imagining FIFA. And because people like Joey Cheek, who's a gold medal Olympian, Joey Cheek. Joey Cheek had his visa revoked. He was trying to go to China to be part of protest there. He was denied that opportunity by the Chinese government. The IOC didn't do squat. I'm 1/1,000th the sort of person in terms of stature, maybe 1/1,000,000,000th of Joey Cheek. But I tried to go to China. I put in a media credential to go over to China. It was rejected by China. I was not allowed to go over there because they thought, I mean, I assume they looked at some of the things I'd written and didn't want me over there. I have to assume that happened to other people. I know people who went over there to do zap actions, particularly around the issue of Tibet. And they said it was like the craziest thing they'd ever seen. Like they unfurled a banner in the middle of Beijing and they were scooped up like faster than you could say Men in Black.
It's scary, isn't it? The idea that they try to pretend that this isn't a political event when it's, I mean, everything about it, maybe just the part that 10 seconds of competition isn't political, but everything else is so bloody politicized.
Right. Swirling around those 10, 20, 30 magic seconds. And what they're really banking on is that we love the 2-minute floor routine, the 10 second sprint, whatever the case may be. They're banking on the fact that we love that so much, we'll put up with all the other crap. Or maybe they're just banking on the fact that a lot of us have TiVos now and DirecTV or what have you, and we'll just fast forward right through it and not see it and go right to the events. But either way, I really think, and I think frankly this is true of all sports, that they're counting on us eating a lot of you-know-what to get that little bit of sugar.
Yeah, but you know what? Part of that is also drinking a lot of Coca-Cola, a company based in Atlanta, Georgia. And I wonder if, you know, just the sympathetic population in the world were to say, hey, I'm not going to drink Coke. I'm not going to use this Olympic product. We're at the day and age where that has more of an effect than anything political because they're the ones who pay the politicians.
You know, that's actually a terrific point because one of the great things I love about social media, and yes, there's a lot to hate about social media, not the least of which it's like J. Edgar Hoover's nocturnal emission. We put all our personal information online and it's just out there for everybody to see. Not trying to sound paranoid, but it's kind of crazy when you think about it. But the one thing I love about social media is that you get to have these kinds of discussions. And I put my article up today and someone put out a really cool plan to say, I said, I agree with you. Athletes shouldn't boycott. But what if there was a simultaneous corporate boycott to protest the fact that the International Olympic Committee hasn't been saying jack about Russia's laws? And it was actually, I think that's a really clever, interesting idea, which I bet gains steam as the day grows close.
We've got a few minutes left with Dave Zirin from The Nation, from Grantland.com, from a lot of great places. Follow him on Twitter at Edge of Sports. Dave, before we let you go, I want to ask you about this article you wrote this week for The Nation about the city of Detroit. A city that is planning to finance a $656 million hockey arena for Mr. Illich and his pizza, Little Caesars Red Wings.
Yeah, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your pensions. It's amazing. Like Detroit is in the throes of bankruptcy. What that means in practice is that if you're making a $19,000 a year pension, the city is going to pay you basically 10 cents on the dollar. Of your pension. I mean, they're just gutting any sense of municipal life in the city. And to have them announce that, and then the same week have it announced that they were going ahead with this arena, to me it was stadium economics through the crazy looking glass, like the sort of thing that if someone wrote it in fiction, you wouldn't think it was serious. Like, yeah, we have no money, except for the billionaire pizza owner guy. And that's the sort of thing. I mean, they're really, this isn't just my voice on this at all. There's a lot of rounds of criticism really asking what are the priorities for Michigan.
One of the things that really struck me in your article, something I learned about many, many years ago, the murals painted by Diego Rivera that are iconic visions. This was Frida Kahlo's husband. And these were the iconic visions of what a socialist auto workers industry in Detroit would look like in the future. And it looks like they're going to have to sell those in order to pay for the for crying out loud, the average civil servant salary in Detroit is $19,000 a year. So I guess it'll pay for a few years and for a couple of streetlights, and maybe the cops will show up in 45 minutes instead of the 58 right now. But this is a scary situation, and they just did this with a football stadium, and they just did this with a baseball stadium.
Yeah, and like I quote Stephen Colbert in the article saying that Rivera's mural is going to be sold to the Museum of Irony, which is, I think, right on. you know, the art sales may not go through. There's been enough uproar about this, especially because it's penny wise, pound foolish. Like, I mean, they're going to get not too much for the art. And then what's it really going to do in terms of getting Detroit out of an $18 billion bankruptcy? But I'll tell you this, if you're trying to dig yourself out of an $18 billion hole, there is no economic evidence that says $300 million into Mike Ilitch's pocket is the way to do it.
You know, maybe the fine people of South Florida who just got bilked out of into building a stadium could write a nice letter to the city of Detroit and remind the that. And not only that, Dave, people are moving out of there in droves. So who's going to sit in the stadium? Who's going to pay to sit and go to these games?
Well, that's the worst part of it, is that, you know, Detroit is still a great hockey town, but it's a suburban hockey town. I mean, people are coming from outside of Detroit. And so if people coming from outside to go into Detroit, they're not going to stay in Detroit and spend money. They're not going to stay in Detroit and hang out. They're going to stay in Detroit if there's no infrastructure in Detroit. The whole thing, I mean, it's got economic disaster written all over it. But, hey, at least 87-year-old Mike Ilitch is happy. And I think that's the most important thing, that his future will be financially secure.
We'll play out, Dave, on one of your favorite tunes here, Marco. Let's bump this up.
Better not be Robin Thicke.
He's the best guest on the Kaufman Show for a reason. Follow him at Edge of Sports. Dave, thank you so much for your time tonight. Should I pretend to be him and say, you're welcome, Dave? That's it for Dave Zirin. Follow him at Edge of Sports, one of the sharpest commentators on sports and politics around. One of my favorites. Play me out, Marco. Man. You're possessed. Gord Downie and the Country of Miracles on the Kaufman Show. Welcome back. So do I spend the next hour and 20 minutes begging for an Oceaga ticket for Saturday? Or how does this work? I'm not sure what the protocol is.
If you love something, set it free.
If you're selling, I'm buying. Let's go to the phones. 514-790-1690. Who owns us? Who owns this company?
Bell.
Bell. That's right. So if you're going to call long distance, you might as well have it be on our dime, not yours. Because we're owned by...
Bell.
That's it, Bell. 1-866-896-2546 if you're out of the 514. Once again, if you're here, 790-1690. Let's go to, oh, I like this, Park X Peter. That'd be a cool nickname. Park X Peter, what's shaking?
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you, Peter?
Good. About 10 days ago,
yes,
I sent you an email concerning the Montreal Expos. I don't know if you check your email or if you, I don't know, you know, we're people, we're on vacation, we have something to do. Sometimes we don't get our emails.
It's possible. I don't remember specifically what email you're discussing.
Okay, well, in a few days ago, I had a discussion with a very good friend of mine concerning the Montreal Expos.
Okay.
There's not a fan in Montreal who doesn't want to see the Expos come back again.
I can think of a few, but all right.
I'm sure most of us, if you pulled us, they would say, yeah, bring back the Expos.
Sure.
But, okay, we'll get back the Expos. But the problem is, at what cost? And where is these people who want to support the team? I'm talking specifically about the business community.
Well, you know, there was a $400,000 study financed by the Montreal Chamber of Commerce in the spring, of which we're expecting answers in the fall. And that should give us a lot of the answers. Now, I'm willing to bet that that feasibility study, if you're paying $400,000 for it, it's going to come back with the answers that you want to hear, which is that the community is ready, the people are there, the product needs to be there. This, obviously, it can't be the Olympics, the Olympic Stadium. And I'll say one more thing, Peter. I think it's very important. I can't even describe how important it is for this to be privately financed. Because the second that anybody hears about public money going into this, it's going to die. I don't want to see one tax dollar go towards a new stadium or a baseball team. That is a mistake. We just had Dave Zirin on talking about that mistake in regards to the city of Detroit, who are about to build their third publicly financed stadium. That's that would be suicide. That would be the end of the movement for the Montreal Expos. There is no way that you could get the public on board with spending public money. It would not add up. We see $2 billion being wasted over the next 30 years in Miami because they financed the stadium. We see Detroit going to hell. And frankly, Montreal's already got enough problems as it is. Somebody wrote an op-ed to the Gazette today saying that all the people that would be qualified to bring us a new stadium are too busy testifying at the Charbonneau Commission. Anyway, Peter, thank you for the call. Let's go to Frank. Let's go to Frank. Let's go to Frank.
Travis in North Carolina.
Oh, Travis. Sorry, Travis. I was trying to figure out what that bottom line said there. where's he from? Hello, Travis. Welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good.
Good.
And I have put my name. I can't read French that well anymore, so I messed it up. I put my last name first, unfortunately, but I
screw that up all the time. There was something with the we reset it today so that Americans can sign up. We realized just how many Americans would be interested in buying a season ticket package. All the people in Vermont, Massachusetts, Upper New York State. That's a thing.
Or North Carolina, even.
Even North Carolina, although you're moving, aren't you?
Eventually. Unless Tropicana Field imploded and they were like, oops, the stadium. You know, yeah, I think I'd have time.
I'm sure you'll be back north of the Mason-Dixon by the time a baseball team returns.
Indeed. And while you rightfully are against public funding,
yeah,
are you against granting tax-free areas?
Well, tax-free and tax-based incentives are two different things in my mind.
Yeah.
So the Bell Center, which was then the Molson Center, was built with private money, but given a very sweet deal on the land. And that makes sense to me. I mean, you have to give them some sort of an incentive. But
yeah,
that money could, you know what, for the cost of what they want to use to fix the roof at the Olympic Stadium right now, that's pretty much what the Bell Center costs to make from top to bottom.
Well, the Bell Center was also properly designed. That helps.
Yeah, it does help. It does help. You know, they had 20 years of foresight, right?
And it's a shame that, you know, it's been kind of more misery than the Forum, but, you know, our shucks can't win them all.
You know what? I don't think that has to do with off-ice. I think if the Canadians had won a Stanley Cup or two at the Bell Center, people wouldn't be down on it. And I don't really think there isn't really a bad seat in the building.
No, as long as your wallet is fat.
You know what? I've heard that a lot. It's a lot more expensive to go to a game in Toronto. My season tickets are reasonable. I mean, they've gone up every single year since I've had them. but they're reasonable. It's, you know, 40 bucks a game to sit up in the sky. And if I wanted a good view, I'd sit home and watch it on television.
Yeah.
But there's, the you know, you're paying for the atmosphere. You're paying to be there. And if you want to not have it be such a crazy expensive night, don't buy three beers.
Yeah, but are people going to pay similar amounts for baseball? I would hope so, at least in the first decade.
Well, you shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
You know, a baseball stadium's twice the size, and there are twice as many games. It shouldn't cost as much to go to a baseball game as it does to go to a hockey game.
Well, I've actually heard the argument before that particularly Montreal should build a smaller stadium, like 30,000 seats, or maybe even less.
Well, Pittsburgh's is around 30. Boston's is around 30.
Well, Boston has a couple of quirks, doesn't it?
Yeah, a couple. A couple. Fenway Park is a lot more fan-friendly than it was when I first went about 12 years ago, though. They've sunk a lot of money into making that a very friendly and warm. It's not that antiquated, uncomfortable stadium that it used to be.
Yeah, but, you know, I like the character of the old stadium, though. Even if they are a little bit messy.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't build something to. I mean, I guess you sort of can. Camden Yards comes to mind. They built that. That's a new ballpark that's built to be an old ballpark. Anyway, did you catch our interview with Dave Zirin?
I did. Yes.
Pretty interesting stuff, eh?
It is, and you know what a mess in Russia. What a mess.
What a mess. What?
What a mess.
Oh, in Sochi, yeah. Well, I mean, look, any time that you mix sports and politics, you're bound to have some trouble along the way. And I'm very curious to see how this, I mean, this has been going on for, I guess, what, a couple of months now, but it's really only hit the media in the last couple of weeks. And I'm very curious to see how the world reacts to it.
It's a wonder it's in the media at all. I mean, the IOC loves stretching its muscles to hide things like this. This is what they do.
Yeah, but it's in the media because guys like Patrick Burke and guys like Dave Zirin are standing up and insisting that it's in the media, and that's very admirable and very important.
Maybe it's a sign the IOC's reign of terror could be loosening a little bit.
I doubt it. You know, I am a voracious drinker of Diet Coke. I drink way too much of it. And for the last few days, I've been thinking, like, that would be a way for me to say, I don't stand with this. Because, again, athletes aren't going to boycott. The last time there was a boycott, it was such a disaster that athletes aren't going to boycott again.
And we don't want another Simpsons punchline in 20 years.
No, you don't want another Krusty Burger incident like you had in 84.
Exactly.
It's scary to think, though, if I was a gay athlete, I would be... I'd be terrified right now. I mean, it's just not fair to have that kind of distraction hanging over your head while you're training for the thing that you've been training your whole life for.
It's not fair. And while everyone seems to be so sure they're not going to arrest athletes,
it doesn't matter if they are or are not. That needs to be removed from it. The fact that that law exists and that the world community and, you know, the major financial corporations of the world are all descending upon Russia. And, you know, I mentioned it with Dave that there's going to be this opening ceremony that's going to show, you know, the plow and the wheat field and the strong Russian peasant and working all the way up through the years to the greatness of the communist era, to perestroika. And the world is going to be forced to watch that. And it's going to be this 2-hour endorsement that, like we saw in London with the Kenneth Branagh live play that they had going on. And like we saw in Vancouver. And, you know, that's part of the game. If you do this type of thing, then you get to have, you know, you put up the money for the Olympics, you get a 2-hour commercial at the opening ceremonies for your country.
The thing is, though, I'm not so sure that there are ways to harass someone when you have credentials that don't involve arresting them.
Of course.
And I don't see any reason why, you know, Russia isn't exactly the most honest place in the world. Nothing against Russia, but it's not. Corruption is a huge problem there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the country is I think the problem is that as Canadians, as Americans, as wherever in the world we've come to the realization that that gay rights issues are human rights issues, we need to stand up, and even for the gays in Russia, we need to stand up for this. The idea that, you know, that Americans and Canadians are no longer allowed to adopt Russian children?
Yes, because there was an incident here with a family sent a kid back.
No, it's actually to do with the fact that any country that has legalized gay marriage.
No kidding.
They've put a ban on adoptions from that country.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So that affects a lot of people.
I just hope there's something organized that people who are concerned, people who care about human rights, can do something when it happens, even if it's something not huge, just something to demonstrate that the caring world cares.
Patrick Burke said that if he were a fan, he would not spend a penny in that country. And you know what? I've always wanted to go to Russia. In the last couple of weeks, I've realized that I'm not going to be able to.
Well, not for the next 30
years. I mean, I could. I just don't want to spend 2 weeks in the gulag. Seems like a bad usage of my time. Travis, thank you so much for the call, man. We'll catch up soon.
Cheers.
And on that, we're going to call that a sad note? We're going to call that a happy note? Should we just, on that note, let's shift gears and bring in Torben Rolfson. He is the Kaufman Show's resident comedian. That's right. We go all the way out to Vancouver, BC to reach him every single week. He's the Henny Youngman of our time. Mr. One-Liner. It's Henny Youngman, Marco. Take my wife, please. Take my wife everywhere, but she always finds her way home. let's bring in Torben. You can follow him on Twitter at VanGuy. He also writes for The Province out there. And like I said, he's a weekly contributor to The Kaufman Show. I know a couple of people have come up to me on the street and said that this is their favorite segment on The Kaufman Show. So no pressure, but let's welcome Torben. And hello, Torben.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. This is my least favorite segment of the Kaufman Show. I'm glad someone's enjoying it.
Well, sure, because every other one you get to listen to.
Right. How are things?
Things are well. Things are very well. It's been a very busy couple of weeks, and that's good. You don't have any Oceaga tickets, do you?
I do not.
Oh, geez. All right. No. All right. All right. So what's going on this week, Torben?
Yeah, I've just been reviewing all the fun and games in the wide world of sports. You saw that clip, unhappy with an umpire's balls and strikes. Red Sox David Ortiz destroyed a dugout phone with his bat.
Yeah, I saw that.
What is his reasoning there? If I'm not getting calls, then no one is. And I just saw the August issue of the Seattle Mariners magazine, another Mariner on the cover.
No way, really?
Almost less cover subject variety than the Oprah magazine. And former Major Leaguer Robert Fick, he admitted to using steroids twice in his career to recover from injuries. Time to put an asterisk next to that. 69 career homers and .258 batting average.
I saw him hit one to beat the Expos at Comerica Park. Yeah.
Wow.
Let's strike that. That Galarraga solo shot would have counted for the win.
And reports say visitors to Biogenesis in Miami also included NBA players. Yeah, but they only went because they thought it was a nightclub.
Marco likes that one.
Andrew Bynum said he's never really played in a supportive NBA city. Is he looking for a title or a 12-step program?
He could play for the Jazz then, maybe.
There you go. And did you see New York City Council gave Madison Square Garden a 10-year deadline to move, but the New York Times building gets to stay? Yeah, we've got architecture jokes here on the Kaufman Show.
Oh, you know it.
Cowboy Stadium has been rechristened AT&T Stadium in a huge naming rights deal. And you thought the Super Bowl power outage was bad. Watch what happens to your cell phone coverage in Arlington. NFL, there's no excuse for Riley Cooper's actions. I can't believe he attended a Kenny Chesney concert.
Well done, sir. Well done.
The NFL, you saw they're eliminating the AFC versus NFC format from the Pro Bowl beginning in 2014. Bud Selig is confused. How will they determine who gets to be the home team for the Super Bowl?
Oh, God.
And a photo was released that appeared to show Aaron Hernandez holding a gun. Another surprising photo shows Phillip Rivers holding onto a football.
Hi-o.
Hey-o. Texas A&M Heisman winner Johnny Manziel, a.k.a. Johnny Football, was thrown out of a University of Texas frat party last Friday night. Who holds frat parties in July?
Well, I don't know.
Does that seem strange to you?
Frat parties in July. I feel like that's part of the whole American college football, you know.
Year-round kind of deal?
I think so. I think some of those towns just go year-round. I mean, football practices go year-round, right?
They should be backpacking around Europe.
Johnny Backpack?
Yeah, Johnny Backpack. That'd be great. Notre Dame has a new policy banning large handbags and knapsacks from games, but head coach Brian Kelly will continue to bring lots of baggage into the stadium.
Hey! Mixing it up. Yeah. The whole audience, the whole studio was laughing.
The audience. Finally, Chinese authorities want Macau to shed its lingering reputation for seediness and corruption. To achieve this, they're promoting boxing cards.
Wow.
Why don't they just make Don King the mayor?
Yeah, their most truculent mayor yet. Torben Rolfsson, follow him on Twitter at VanGuy. Thank you, Torben. We'll catch you next week.
Have a great night, guys.
Thanks. You too.
Yep.
There he goes, Torben Rolfsson. We're going to be we're gonna take a little break. Marco's got a Sports Center update for you. Yes, he does, and it's going to be good. There'll be scores and sprots and players. And who owns us again?
A guy lost his job today.
You know, I saw Dan Hawkins after the win last week with his entire family at Subway after the game. He was really nice, very polite, bought his whole family Subway.
Hey, if he had gone to Dagwoods, he'd still have a job right now.
It's the Kaufman Show. We'll be back with an in-studio guest, Andrew Berkshire from Eyes on the Prize. He's going to teach us about fancy stats. I'm looking forward to it. Welcome back to The Kaufman Show. I am Dave. You can follow me on Twitter at The Kaufman Show. Marco Polo on the board. John Kakalak is helping us out, and we've got an in-studio guest. His name is Andrew Berkshire. Somebody I've been following on Twitter for a long time. And, you know, Andrew, I have to say, you're the only person I know that I follow on Twitter that hates baseball. And yet you've managed to stay. And it's because you offer something really cool, man. Your hockey analysis is fantastic. Andrew runs the Eyes on the Prize website. That is the domain, right? Is Eyes on the Prize?
Yeah, it's Habs Eyes on the Prize technically, but it's Eyes on the Prize is the actual name of the site.
Okay. Yeah. And one thing that you've been concentrating on this summer has been, you've been doing it for a while, but you've been starting to try and reach out to people who don't understand the modern hockey statistic and teach it to them. You call it fancy stats.
Yeah, it's kind of, the thing about fancy stats is a lot of people don't get it right away, but it's kind of, sarcastic, because the whole thing about quote-unquote advanced stats in hockey is that they're really not advanced. It's just that they're given names that aren't intuitive, so people automatically assume that they're very complicated, but they're not. So fancy stat is kind of like, it's real fancy. Like,
right.
It's not serious. So that's why we called it that, is kind of a joke, poking fun at the whole community, really, because there's a lot of people who are very look down their nose, condescending about it, and it's just something that you really can't be condescending about. They're not complicated.
Well, we saw this in the world of baseball, and it was magnified last year when a player by the name of Mike Trout, a rookie, gave Miguel Cabrera a real run for his money for the MVP award. And it seemed that people who appreciate the modern statistics and the way to analyze baseball in the modern way were all for Trout winning the MVP. The establishment, who looks at the traditional stats that you'll see on the back of a baseball card, all went for Cabrera. And I feel like this is something similar that's turning. You're seeing younger analysts and younger commentators appreciate these statistics, and you're seeing the establishment in hockey shun it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can see that right away when you tune into CBC, and you can see Elliot Friedman on one side, where he actually has a little bit of knowledge about it and tries to bring it in. And then you have PJ Stock, who's not old, but he's in that old school mentality, and he'll just roll his eyes and kind of laugh it off and totally ignore it. And you've got that same thing in media. I think it's getting more towards...
To be fair, though, Andrew, if you remember when he hosted a show here, just discussing evolution with him was a bit of a challenge, wasn't
it? Oh, seriously?
Wasn't there something about everybody was a monkey once?
Yeah, that was in a promo. I even got another CBC fellow right here.
Do you? I wonder which one this one is.
78 pucks towards the net. 78. So the goalie was the key. And it's not so much the number of saves, and I don't believe in your Corsi stuff. I'm just going to ignore it. When he made the...
Okay.
Doesn't that drive you up the wall?
It does, but the funny thing is that he uses Corsi, and then he's like, I don't believe in that stuff. Because, like, the original, what Corsi is...
Yeah, let's
is
start
just,
there.
Okay, what we'll do is Corsi is just shot attempts. So it means shots, goals, shots that miss the net, and shots that are blocked. So when he says 78 shots toward the net, he means 78 Corsi events.
Okay.
So he's saying it in a way that is more understandable. But the way it was originally designed was by goaltending coach Jim Corsi from the Buffalo Sabres.
Former NHL goaltender.
And he designed it to judge how much work a goalie was doing, because goalies don't just face shots. For every shot attempt, they go down into the butterfly. They have movement. Well, it doesn't measure everything either. Like, even passes across the ice, they have to slide across their crease. You know, there's a lot of work a goalie does every game that's not measured. But it turned out that it was even better at predicting possession, time of possession for forwards and defensemen, so skaters on the ice between teams. And that's how it's used now, is calculating time of possession for each team.
Which is not a stat that people look at very often, but you'd imagine that the team that has the puck more would be the one that's in control of the game.
Exactly. And most of the time we separate it into game situations. So you have even strength, power play, penalty kill, and then you also separate even strength down to situations like whether the score is tied or not, or whether it's close. And when somebody references that the score is close, what they mean is that it's within one goal in the first two periods or tied in the third.
Okay.
And the reason why people do that is because when teams lead by a lot of goals, they tend to sit back. This was a big criticism of Jacques Martin when he was the coach of the Canadiens. He would sit on leads. Well, it turns out that every team in the NHL sits on leads. To varying degrees, of course.
Now, you mean by sitting on leads, you would mean like resting the first liners in a 6-1 game, right?
It could mean that, and it doesn't necessarily mean that. Sometimes it just means that the teams relax. They don't push the offense as much. They sit back in a defensive shell. And I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but when teams do that, they do give up fewer goals per shot against. So that's why we kind of take those shots out, because it's not a true talent measurement of the team they're against, because you have the team sitting back, right?
Okay.
So we try to measure it down to when the teams are on even footing as much as we can.
Would the reason for these, and Corsi specifically, be to try and show how a player performs when it matters versus just at any old time in a game?
I guess you could say it's when it matters, but I would just say it's just when the teams are on even footing, and that's the purest information that you can get to. I don't know if it's... because it's not really a measurement of clutch. It's just, on average, how this player is going to perform in a normal game situation. Most of the game situation is played in a certain way, so we try to stick into that to get our analysis of it.
If we were to try and search for one statistic that we think could break into the mainstream in the next year, which one would that be?
Well, I think Corsi is breaking in. You hear a lot on TV now, people will reference shot attempts, they just don't say Corsi.
Okay.
But I do think that the better statistic is Fenwick, which is the same as Corsi, only it takes out blocked shots. Because I find that teams can be good at blocking shots.
See, this is like how there were two different versions of WAR at the start in baseball, which confused a whole bunch of people. There was WAR, and then there was F WAR, I think, or something like that. And they finally decided last offseason to consolidate them and run with one WAR. And I think that this is probably something similar, where people, you know, frankly, before I started doing some research for tonight's interview, the only two fancy stats I'd heard of were Corsi and Fenwick.
Yeah, and they're the same thing, basically.
Great. But you could see how that would confuse people.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And especially when you're looking at those names, I mean, you look at a hockey game and you don't ever say the word Fenwick.
No.
Without thinking about it, you know, like, you don't say, oh, yes, that guy's got good Fenwick. Like, it doesn't make any sense to the regular hockey viewer. And that's
no,
why,
but in the way that you know, maybe plus minus didn't resonate to somebody when they first started watching hockey.
This is true.
You know, that took some time to get used to. And now I feel that the new establishment in hockey sort of, you know, tuts plus minus.
Oh, definitely. Plus minus is a very flawed stat.
And why?
The reason why is because it's based on such a low number of events. It's only based on goals. And the other thing is that it's not just even strength. It also includes if you get scored against while you're on the power play, shorthanded goal against, that's mostly a luck event. And there are five players on the ice who get a minus for it, and it's usually one player's fault. And, you know, sometimes the goalie will make that save. It's very, very small sample size to get a minus out of, right? And it counts a lot because there's not very many of them. And a lot of goal scoring is based on random events. People don't like to admit it. Some people call it luck, but what it really is unrepeatable performance. And basically across the NHL, the amount of goals that go in per shot is relatively even. It's between, you know, 8 or 9% at even strength, or 7 or 9% at even strength. And it sticks there no matter how talented your team is. That's just the way that it goes in the salary cap era. There are times, though,
which reflects the 920 save percentage of
yes.
the goalie, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But that's, again, specifically at even strength. So, like, a
right.
920 at even strength is not as impressive as, like, a 920 overall.
Right,
because you're
course.
Taking out shorthanded shots, right?
Sure.
But the main thing is that you can have one line, like, say, Max Pacioretty, Eric Cole, and David Desharnais the year before. They shot the lights out. They shot at around 10.5% the entire year. So they had really nice high plus minuses even on a bad team. But that's not sustainable. You know, their shooting percentages regressed this year.
Well, and also
from
what you're saying, that would have evened out over the other three lines, right?
Yes, yeah.
So we would have had a line that was probably at a 6% to balance out the 10.
Very much so.
Or 3.7s to, and I mean, I don't want to deluge our listeners with numbers, but I find this to be a really interesting way of looking at hockey. Now, which one of these stats do you think we're going to see first on the back of a hockey card?
Ooh, that's hard to know. Probably zone starts. I think that's the one that's easiest for people to grasp and has the most immediate impact. Because what a zone start is simply where a player starts his shift on a faceoff. So it's a coach's deployment. And say a person or a player like David Desharnais, we'll stick with him, he starts most of his shifts in the offensive zone because he's an offensive player and he's not very good defensively. So the coach is limiting his defensive work as much as he can. It's very simple. It doesn't account for changes on the fly, but especially when you look at how the coach uses him on home ice, it can be very indicative of what that player's skill set is and how the coach views that player.
Well, that's interesting. That's not something I had thought about. And I guess, yeah, that's one that people could probably wrap their heads around pretty easily.
Yeah.
But you could look at that number and just go, oh, that player's terrible. Coach hates him.
You could, but I mean, again, with all these statistics, you can't just look at it and make a value judgment.
Why is Bill Lindsay taking that face off? His zone starts number is, oh, and the game's over.
Well, yeah, and some people do freak out about stuff like that, but it's one of those things where you have to kind of tell people that the minutia, like whenever you look at something, one single event, anything can happen, so one single event isn't even really worth talking about. You just watch the game, you enjoy it, and then you can look back every 5-6 games and look at what happened and make some value judgments there. But there's no reason to freak out over like one single face-off, even if it goes badly. I mean, you look at the 2011 playoffs when they started Jeff Halpern, mm-hmm. who's excellent in the defensive zone, plays most of his starts in the defensive zone. He got waved out of the face-off in overtime. Plekanec had to take it. Well, Plekanec is also really good in the defensive zone. Lost the faceoff, and then Halpern accidentally tipped the shot in, and series over.
Well, even the good ones outside of, like, Yannick Perreault only win them 50% of the time,
exactly.
Right?
And that's one thing that's really debated right now is how important faceoffs actually are. It was the Toronto bloggers talked about this a lot when Mikhail Grabowski was bought out and the Maple Leafs elected to keep Tyler Bozak, was that one of the reasons was that Bozak was really good on faceoffs. And they worked it out, And the difference in their faceoff percentage came down to something like under 50 faceoff wins per season.
Wow. Which and is it's tiny.
Just, it's very tiny. And these percentages, like most players in the NHL, are between 45 and 55%. There's a few outliers like Patrice Bergeron, but they're very few and far between. And the amount of faceoffs that you have to win to score one goal is something like 100.
Like, wow.
That's how many faceoffs you have to win in order to create a goal off of a faceoff. It's very rare.
So that's, you know, a goal every couple of games, essentially.
Basically.
Or more.
More.
Really? Yeah, probably every few games. I mean, yeah. you don't win 50 faceoffs in 60 minutes.
Exactly.
Well, interesting stuff, Andrew. We're joined by Andrew Berkshire on the Kaufman Show. We got a couple of minutes left. And Marco, do you have any questions?
Yeah, it's the quality of competition. Like, how do you calculate that? That's what I can't wrap my head around.
Yeah, we actually haven't done that one yet on the summer school that we're running on Eyes on the Prize because I'm struggling to kind of explain it in a way that's really easy to understand. And it's the one that I think I have to be most careful with. But basically, quality of competition can be measured in a variety of ways. The most common one that we use is Corsi, just because it has the most events. And it's just a weighted average of the Corsi plus minus of your opponents.
But the Corsi from like the last season isn't an ongoing accumulation?
It's an ongoing accumulation wow. during the season. So it's like it's the most complicated to calculate statistic out of all of them. So like if you play against Patrice Bergeron for 20 minutes one game and it's the 70th game, it can barely touch
right
what your quality of competition is.
Also, how do we clone Jordan Staal?
Well, that's actually pretty easy. You go to Denmark and you find Lars Eller.
Oh, really? You're that high on Eller? Interesting. I don't know. Jordan Staal to me is like one of a kind. Brandon Setter is all right, but Penguins very lucky they got him. But wouldn't you agree Jordan Staal could be one of the greatest Corsi players ever by the end of his career?
He's definitely up there. The thing with Jordan Staal is that he was able to do it so young. I mean, he was 18 years old and one of the youngest 18-year-olds ever to go into the NHL. And he played tough minutes right off the bat, and he was a positive guy. And it's pretty crazy. I mean, he hasn't really gotten to a level where he's producing first-line numbers that blow you out of the water, but he's playing those tough minutes and excelling. I mean, he's kind of what Patrice Bergeron is, not quite as high-end. He doesn't have that same offense, but he plays an important role. Eller's not as good as Jordan Staal, but this year he showed that he can be that, he can play that role. And I think as the seasons go on, as Plekanec gets a little bit older, because Plekanec plays the toughest minutes on the team right now, Eller's going to slowly take over that role, and we'll probably start seeing that next year.
And Jordan Staal's coach as an 18-year-old was
Michel Therrien.
It hasn't shown a penchant for, you know what I mean, putting a lot of faith in young guys like P.K. Subban, but he did once with
Jordan
Staal.
Well, yeah, so he did. Eller, he also did with Chris Letang that year.
Yeah, Eller has got to show something that will allow Therrien to, I guess, give him more minutes.
He came within a win of a Stanley Cup that year as well.
Yeah.
And then ended up on his butt. Isn't the world of hockey nice? And I want to close, actually, Andrew, by asking you about the playoffs, and especially last year's playoffs. Did we see elevated fancy stats from the winner, from Chicago or from Boston, or is that too small a sample size?
Well, the playoffs is always a bit of a crapshoot when it comes to who's going to win, fancy stats, stuff like that. I mean, LA was by far the best team the year before. Like, it wasn't even close. Once they acquired Jeff Carter, they were basically the best team since these stats have been measured. They were almost that good this year, like right back up there, but they kind of ran out of gas in the playoffs. Chicago was the first or second best team in the league, depending on what stat you're using to calculate it.
Right.
Boston's right up there, too. So, like, the two teams that got there, that was a heck of a finals. But I wouldn't say that that's the only reason that they won or anything like that. There's so many other things in a seven-game series that you can't measure. Things like intimidation and the mental thing that goes into it is so big. It can't be underestimated. And with the Canadiens specifically, I mean, the Canadiens massively, massively outplayed the Ottawa Senators in possession stats. Like, not even close. And people said, oh, well, you know, they were too small. Well, if you're too small, most likely you're not going to get more scoring chances than the other team. You're not going to be in their crease. They're going to keep you out. Montreal got something like 57% of the scoring chances in that series. The difference was Price wasn't so great, whether he was injured or whether he was not so good anyway. And Craig Anderson was amazing. The Canadiens lost depth. They lost Pacioretty. Well, Pacioretty being effective with the separated shoulder. They lost Lars Eller in game one, and he was tearing it up at that point in the season. And Brian Gionta going out, that was huge too. And Alexi Emelin, it was just like death by a thousand pinpricks, you know?
Yeah, but you don't look at it and think that the Habs had, you know, like you said, 57%. And as we discussed right off the top of this segment, normally that shows you who wins the hockey game.
Normally it does, but again, small sample sizes, things can not go your way. And that's why the playoffs, like, they're so tough. And the best thing you can do to win a Stanley Cup is you can't go all in for 1 year like Pittsburgh did this year. You have to build for, like, a decade. And you say, we'll give ourselves the best shot to win for this time period. Mm-hmm. And maybe one of those times you'll get through. And one of those times you'll win. Or maybe you'll win twice. Maybe you win four times like the Red Wings did. You just don't know, and you have to give yourself the longest possible period of competitive teams to be able to get in. It's just the world of hockey has changed so much from the 70s and 80s where you could have dynasties. It just can't happen anymore.
Well, there's a few more teams as well.
There are, and there's a lot more good teams, I think, is the biggest difference. I mean, if you look at the 80s and you see like there's like four or five teams that have huge point numbers, and then in their divisions you've got people making the playoffs that had a losing record. Whereas now, teams that make the playoffs in 7th and 8th, they're actually really good teams.
Like the Kings 2 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrew, thank you so much for your time. I hope we can do this again before the season starts.
Me too.
Awesome. Follow him on Twitter at Andrew Berkshire, as well as Habs EOTP. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's the Kauffman Show on TSN 690 Radio. If you missed any part of tonight's show, including our awesome interviews with Andrew Berkshire and Dave Zirin, head over to thekauffmanshow.podbean.com. Those podcasts will be up within about 20 minutes of the show's conclusion. You can check out last week's interviews that are up online with Eddie Izzard, Adsit and Lutz from 30 Rock, and most importantly, Patrick Burke. Awesome interview with Berkey last week. So we have some interesting... You know, I was listening to the Drive Home show before the show started today, and they were talking about Riley Cooper. Ted was talking about Riley Cooper, played a very interesting clip from Stephen A. Smith that I disagree with. Shockingly, I disagree with Stephen A. Talking about Riley Cooper, of course, second string wide receiver on the Philadelphia Eagles. Was it a Kenny Chesney concert, as Torben Rolfsson joked about, which is ridiculous. But even worse was that he used the N-word at the show. And he mentioned, I don't remember the exact quote, but it was, I want to jump up and fight every N-word in here. And Stephen Smith made the comment that that players shouldn't, well, anybody shouldn't use that, but it's so pervasive in the locker rooms and that you hear it in hip hop and they hear it in all these other places. And that makes it not okay, but it makes it more understandable that somebody would use that term. And the only thing I have to say to that is if Riley Cooper was talking about loving N-words, not fighting N-words, then it would be a bit of a different story. But he was talking about fighting black people. He wasn't talking about how awesome they are and, you know, using any kind of, a, oh, that's my N-word in that endearing way that you might hear it. It was fully, let's fight. That plus Kenny Chesney equals problems. Play me out, big man.
I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team, 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 O. I say O-M, O-M-A, O-M-A-L, O-M-A-L-L-E-Y, oh really? No O'Malley. Sandy Koufax, oh my Drysdale Maury Wills, I love you so. And we defy, defy the J-I. J-I-N, J-I-N-T, J-I-N-T-S, Giants! Play ball! Orlando Cepeda is at bat with the bases jammed. Orlando Cepeda with a wham, bam. He hit a grand slam in the very first inning, but it's only the beginning. In the third, like a fight, we get two on and away. Then fairly hits into a double play. Here comes Big Frank Howard, yes siree. Boy, what a swing! Strike three. O-dem B, O-dem B-U, B-U-M, B-U-M-S. Them bums, them bums, them dry bums. Oh, they may be bums, but they're my bums. Top of the fifth, say hey, Willie Mays hits a three-bagger down the right field line. But he's out trying to stretch it to a homer as Roseboro tags him on the bottom of the spine with a crack you can hear all the way back up to San Francisco. Open your hospital! Inning six, Maury Wills draws a walk in the coach's box. Leo DeRocher, Leo DeRocher, starts to wiggle and to twitch. A signal? No, an itch. Go, Maury, go, Maury, go, go, go. Maury goes, the catcher throws right from the solar plexus. At the bag, he beats the tag, that mighty little waif. And umpire Conlon cries, you're out! Out? Out? Down in the dugout, Alston glowers. Up in the booth, Vin Scully frowns. Out in the stands, O'Malley grins. Attendance 50,000. And what does O'Malley do?
Yeah, that keeps going. That's Danny Kaye's Dodgers song. And I love, love, love that Vin Scully gets mentioned. I think that's so cool that that man is still the broadcaster of the L.A. Dodgers and still the class of baseball. John Kakalakis, how often do you get to hear Vin Scully call a game? Do you have the MLB package?
No, I don't.
Oh, man, it's worth the $100. I promise you, you get Vin Scully in your living room every single night.
Calling Mariano Rivera's save last night.
That's pretty cool.
Awesome.
Having him compare Yasiel Puig, hearing him talk about seeing Mantle in his rookie year and seeing Bryce Harper in his rookie year and seeing Puig in his rookie year, that's some pretty cool stuff.
That's excellent. And as baseball fans, watching a young talent like Yasiel Puig and Bryce Harper, obviously last year, it's a privilege to listen to Vince Scully talk about them and just us as fans watching this raw talent come up in the bigs.
One thing that everybody needs to learn who calls baseball games from Vince Scully, or really any sports in general, is to shut up sometimes.
Cepeda runs the field of ball. So does Hiller. So does Miller. Miller hollers Hiller. Hiller hollers Miller. Haller hollers Hiller. Points to Miller with his fist. And that's the Miller Hiller Haller Hallelujah twist. The Davis score, it's 4-4. Howard's still running the bases. From second to third, it's almost absurd. Amazement on everyone's faces. He's heading for home. He hasn't a chance. The poor nut is going to be dead. But the ball hits him right in the seat of his pants. And he scores. That's using your head. So I say D. I say D-O. D-O-D-G-E-R-S. The team that's all heart. All heart and all thumbs, they're my Los Angeles, your Los Angeles, our Los Angeles. Do you think we'll really win the pennant? Bombs, ooh, them bombs.
And the Dodgers, of course, were able to do something this year that... Well, the Blue Jays couldn't. They've gone from last to first. Dodgers have really turned it around, and it all coincides with when Yasiel Puig was called up. Very impressive stuff from the LA Dodgers so far. Kershaw continues to be lights out. The team is exciting. They've rebounded, and they've done it on their non-traditional stars. It hasn't been Matt Kemp. It hasn't been Andre Ethier. It's cool to see.
It's great to see, and Don Mattingly was the one that should have paid the price early in the season. They stuck by him. Yasiel Puig came in, and the troops have gathered together now. And it's funny that we're talking about a 20-year-old gathering the troops. But he's the igniter, and kudos to them. It's unfortunate for the Jays. I'm looking at the Jays pitching staff, and you know, before the season started, there was so much promise, and especially a guy like Josh Johnson. I remember this guy 5 years ago with all the tools.
Before all the injuries.
It's unfortunate for him. It's unfortunate for the Jays. And I was going back to the payrolls of the teams this year in Major League Baseball. And 6 out of the top 10 teams are not in the playoffs right now. 5 of them, I think, will not make them. And that's Jays are one of them. The Angels are another. The Philadelphia Phillies are another. The Yankees are on the bubble. So are the Texas Rangers. And then you go out of the bottom 5, and 3, 4, and 5 being the Pittsburgh Pirates, being the Tampa Bay Rays, and I'm missing one of them. I'll get it to you right now in a sec. That is quite impressive, and we were talking about the Pirates just before the show started.
That's right.
I am so happy for that franchise.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, after 21 seasons, who can forget Sid
Barry
Green?
Barry Bonds, yeah.
Barry Bonds lost last throw against the Atlanta Braves in Game 7.
You know what I remember about that? And it might just be from the Sports Illustrated, which I still own and have probably read 1,000 times. But it was Andy Van Slyke, Bonds, and who would have been their third outfielder, sitting in center field pretending to play cards during a pitching change. And they were just sitting on their butts and pretending to play cards.
Bonilla had left, so it's not Bobby Bonilla.
Okay. I remember vividly that Andy Van Slyke was the center fielder.
That's right, and he was sitting down, his hands on his knees.
Yeah, yeah, an iconic SI photo. Francisco Cabrera
got the base hit, and Sid Bream, the former Pirate, scores the winning run.
That's right, chugging along at a Darren Fletcherian pace.
That's right.
A lot of interesting things going on in Major League Baseball right now. You know, the season is, we're pretty much at the 100-game mark right now. And just the fact, like you said about the Blue Jays, how do you think they feel in Washington, D.C. right now, where the Nationals are 11 games out of first, 4 games under 500, had their opportunity last year and decided to sit Strasburg because they figured they have that window. Like Andrew Berkshire was talking about, as far as hockey goes, I think the baseball version was Washington. They said, we have a window, so we're going to sit them. Well, you sit them. And there's no guarantee that next year you're going to be as good as you were the year before.
Exactly. But it's a tough decision. By the way, the fifth team that I was talking about with the lowest payroll are the Oakland Athletics.
Oh, of course.
We're comfortably sitting on first in the West, in the American League West.
Now, John, the Oakland A's were, they were a dreadful team to start the year last year. And I think in the middle of May, they were probably 10 games under 500. The turnaround by that club of no names outside of Bartolo Colon is so impressive. And they're fun to watch. If you have the opportunity, watch the Oakland A's. That's how baseball should be.
Aren't we used to it by now? It's been a decade where the Oakland Athletics turn it up a notch come July and especially August. But exactly, it's all Billy Beane. I got given this gentleman so much credit for being able to gather players that have the passion for baseball. And his managers have done a great job. And you look at in that division, you got Texas and you got the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim.
Right, with Albert Pujols, who's now probably done for the year. He's making more money than the Astros combined.
It's just to show you. It's incredible.
It's you never know what you're going to get. But the idea of spending $250 million on a player who's going to be past his prime for the most of that contract is about as asinine as spending public money on a stadium.
What do you think Brian Cashman's thinking right now when he gave that contract to A-Rod?
He's thinking he might get out of it, and he's going to be the luckiest GM on the planet.
Will they be able to with a Major League Baseball Players Union is one tough cookie.
They are, and necessarily so when you think about how players have been stepped on forever. But, you know, that's a tough one, John, because does A-Rod deserve $250 million for willfully cheating? The only reason they're trying to give A-Rod a lifetime ban is so he doesn't break the home run record. But truthfully, he's so beaten up, he's probably not going to be able to break that record on his own.
I truly believe the same thing. But the main question that people are talking about, why would A-Rod get a lifetime ban? So people can understand, is it because he lied to Major League Baseball executives? And why is Brian Braun getting 65 games? And A-Rod, they want to ban him for life.
Well, the 65 games for Braun was negotiated, John. They negotiated it.
That's right.
Braun's side wanted less. MLB wanted more. The 65 games allows Braun to basically walk away from a terrible season in Milwaukee. The team's in last place. So he walks away for the end of the year and he can start fresh next year.
Nothing changes in his case. He's right. Still 28, 29 either way.
As far as they're concerned, A-Rod has been lying for longer, I think, and has lied more times. But, I mean, this could run into all kinds of legal issues. I could see this going to court very easily. Alex Rodriguez versus Major League Baseball.
He could be 45 when all this is settled.
Well, at the end of the day, it comes down to this. Is there? Yes, that's true, John. But at the end of the day, it does come down to the fact that MLB doesn't operate within normal legal operating procedures for most companies or corporations. There is that little asterisk somewhere that says that Bud Selig can overrule and do anything he wants. And that was put in 90 years ago when the White Sox threw the World Series and they needed an iron fist to run baseball, and it was Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis. And baseball has basically managed to avoid being... It's ran afoul of the law ever since. It runs by its own rules. It's why it's allowed to be a monopoly.
It's why they allowed all this to happen after the 94 strike, and now they're doing everything they can to clean the sport. So at the same time, in my book, the way I see it, they have a lot to blame for themselves. But who's going to start doing that when the millions were coming back in?
It's amazing how we can sit here and trash Major League Baseball and, you know, the corruption and the cheating and all the rest of it. Man, I love it, and I miss it so much.
Oh, we enjoyed it. I'm not saying otherwise. But I'm just saying, at the end of the day, do not tell me, or I have a hard time believing, that they were not aware of what was going on, and now they're trying to act like we are the nice guys and trying to clean up this sport. That's what I'm just trying to get to.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, yes.
They knew. They knew. They turned a blind eye. They knew.
I'm pretty sure every baseball fan remembers where they were in 1988 in the month of September when Big Mac was hitting that 70th home run off Kyle Pavano, was it? Or
yes,
was it Tony? It was in Montreal Expo.
It was Pavano. It was Pavano. And then rounding third and Shane Andrews tapping him on the ass.
That's right. And then hugging Sammy Sosa because they were playing. Actually, no. Sammy Sosa, they played the Cubs when he
hit
beat 60
when he
Maris.
Beat Maris. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Okay, that's right. Sorry.
He was playing the Expos that final weekend of the season in St. Louis. When McGuire hits, was it 70, 71, and 72?
70.
Okay.
Bonds hit 73.
Oh, yeah, Bonds hit 70. My God. 73 home runs in a season. We barely asked questions because we love the long ball. It's unreal.
And we love mentioning the word Expo, so no matter what, the Montreal Expos will always come back into the conversation.
We always try to work them in as best we can. I had alluded to it earlier in the show, and I'll tell you now, I think I have the perfect spot for a baseball stadium.
I'm listening.
Right across the street from the Forum. Right above Atwater Metro, starting at the corner of St. Catherine Street and Atwater, going down to René Lévesque and Atwater, and then on basically the Cabot Square Park and the Children's Hospital, because that Children's Hospital is moving to the new MUHC site by Vondo Metro. So that's going to be an empty space. It hasn't been called for yet. No condo company has reserved it. That is an open space. It's obviously going to need to be decontaminated a little bit, but that is an open space.
We never said the Expos were coming back in a year or two.
No.
So we'll give them all the time they need.
I feel like that's a spot. That is a large enough plot of land with a metro station underneath.
A little bit of toxic waste won't hurt anyone, right?
Where isn't there toxic waste in this town? Come on.
Cecil Espy or Alex Cole?
Excuse me?
The right fielder for the Pirates in 1992. There are two guys that both played a lot, so I can't figure
Alex out. Cole was the one playing, because I was rewatching that game not too long ago.
I have no recollection of that.
Alex Cole, yeah.
Huh. No.
Mike LaValliere, I'm sure you remember LaValliere making that
catch. If Mike LaValliere had been in the outfield, I would remember that. I would remember that. Let's go to the phones. We've got a few minutes left. We'll take some calls. 514-790-1690, 1-866-896-2546. Dave Kaufman, Marco Polo, John Kakalakis. You can give me a shout on Twitter as well. I am at The Kaufman Show. Let's go to Tom. He's downtown, and he wants to talk about A-Rod. What's up, Tom?
Hey, Dave. Hi, guys.
How are you?
Dave, what do you know about the baseball testing program?
Well, I know that whenever they come up with ways to test for a drug, the cheaters find a new drug that isn't testable. Why? What's going on?
Oh, okay. So, you know, like this is so hypocritical of Major League Baseball, the Players Union, the media. This is all nonsense. When Congress put these guys on the mat there.
Yeah.
The union and management, this is what they came up with, Dave. You know how many players can get tested per year?
A small percentage, isn't it?
A third of the membership.
Yeah.
You know how many times they get tested during the year, Dave?
Spring training and then once at the end, right?
Just once.
Okay, I thought it was twice.
Just once. And then afterwards, all things go. And there's no off-season testing, and there's plenty of time for the stuff they're using now, the strips. If you're doing it properly, and not like Melky Cabrera and the other guys who got caught, if you're doing it properly, there's plenty of time for this to clear your system. So this was all a ruse to show like the media and Congress.
It's optics,
that,
right?
Yeah, that they're doing something. And you know what, Dave? Major League Baseball doesn't care about the A-Rod breaking the home run record. This is nonsense. And Buck Showalter says something today. This is the New York Yankees, the Steinbrenner family, working with Bud Selig to get underneath from underneath his contract, and it's just so bizarre that you know that he's been kept out of the lineup and all this nonsense and what he has done, Dave, what he's trying to do is he's tried to push the point so the suspension could come out. That's why he was saying this and saying that, because this is nonsense. Major League Baseball wants the Yankees to get under $189 million because it's good for their business if they do that, and this is all like collusion between the two parties, and this guy is made to be like some Charles Manson of baseball. It's just ridiculous.
I don't know about Charles Manson.
Oh, that's overstating it. But he is.
I like the Charles Foster Kane reference that Buster Olney pulled out the other day.
But he's not the worst human being to ever play baseball. Let's get serious here.
Well, no, I mean Ty Cobb was a pretty big asshole, right?
Well, the Babe, and a bunch of other guys as well. Mickey Mantle, you know, and nobody says anything about the loot bags Derek Jeter gives to
the gift bags.
Women,
yes, that's
gives
right.
To his women friends. I mean, this guy's got carte blanche in New York to do whatever he wants.
He does, and so did Mickey Mantle. And you know what? It's never A-Rod has never done anything to ingratiate himself to the public or the media the way that Jeter has. Jeter's always been the golden boy, and it doesn't matter how many women traipse in and out of Jeter's Central Park West 50th floor condo, because he's the good Yankee. He's the good, clean-cut Yankee when he's on the field. A-Rod doesn't have that. A-Rod has... You know what A-Rod has? He has a $250 million albatross hanging around his neck. And the fact that he managed to get that while admittedly cheating, I see why MLB wants to screw him. I understand. It's because every time that he steps into a batter's box, he is openly mocking Major League Baseball. I get that.
Well, he can thank Warren Buffett for that contract. It was Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett's a friend of his. He went to Warren Buffett because nobody was nibbling. And Warren Buffett called the other two guys who own the Yes Network, and they put the pressure on the Steinbrenner family to sign this guy. It was not a Cashman. Cashman wanted this guy out of there.
Tom, I came across an article this week that was written by Jim Baumbach, and he writes for Newsday out of New York. And he pulled out his old article from when A-Rod signed. And it said that A-Rod, quote, made many concessions in order for that contract to happen, which I think is absolutely hilarious. He bent to get down to $250 million. Thanks for the call. Let's finish up on Rob, who, look at that, Marco. You wrote that he's a Penguins fan. You guys must be, well, is this what it sounds like when doves cry? Hello, Rob.
Yeah, Penguins, you got embarrassed by Boston. That was incredible. I'm still trying to get over that.
Well, it's August. Get over it.
That's right.
How you doing, man?
Good, good. Just a couple of things here, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's very hard to feel sorry for this guy, A-Rod. A couple of points here.
Yep.
First thing, when he signed the contract 10 years ago, I'm a big Bonds fan. When he signed the contract, he was going to be the clean home run king. The clean, because nothing came out. And I was saying back then, I was calling Mitch back then, A-Rod's not clean. If you see his rookie card, he's 182 pounds.
He was also 17 at the time, wasn't he?
But 1 second. But I know a lot about roids and a lot about juicing. He was skinny. His body did not show muscle, that kind of muscle mass. And you saw throughout the years how he became bigger, his neck, his everything. You can put on some muscle mass. If you put on 6 pounds of muscle, legitimately, you're doing a great job. This guy put on more than 15 pounds.
Right.
So the point here is, to the naked eye, you could see this guy was juicing. And he was supposed to be the clean home run king.
I'll agree with you. Well, I saw him play at Fenway Park in 2001. And, he ran out to shortstop every half inning. And the other half inning, it was Nomar. And it looked like one was a giant and one was a midget. And that game, A-Rod went 4 for 6 with 2 home runs, hit one out of Fenway into the parking lot where my car was parked.
Okay, and my point here now is we come later in the contract, and now all this comes out, and, whatever, and he did what he did. Listen, there's rules now. Back in the day, McGuire, Sosa, there were no drug policies. So Major League Baseball has told these guys, if we catch you, we're going to nail you. And this guy, the thing with A-Rod, he goes in front of students 2 years ago, I remember, and said to the students, you could play this game clean. You don't need the juice. You don't need this. And this happens. And he's the one who recruited all the Spanish boys for this clinic. Enough's enough. He bought it upon himself. Now he's trying to get the lawyers to manipulate everything. No. It's time you pay the price.
Rob, will you call us? We got to go. But will you call us back next week once the suspension's handed down, man? Thanks a lot for the call.
Take care.
You too, buddy. You too. I want to thank all our guests from tonight. Andrew Berkshire, Torben Rolfson, the wonderful Dave Zirin. Thank you, Marco, on the board. Thank you, John Kakalakis, for helping us out. I'm Dave Kaufman. This is The Kaufman Show.
Listen up, kid. It's not what you think. Stayed out too late. Had a little too much to drink. Walk home across the bridge when the marquee shut down. There's a reason that I love this town. Nobody cares how much money you have. If you've got enough to get in a cab, there'll be drinks on the house. If your house burns down, there's a reason that I love this town. I saw your band in the early days. We all understand. Hold a grudge anyway. I shot the shit with miniature Tim. If he needs a tune, then I'll write one for him. We like the same books and we like the same sounds. It's the reason that I love this town. I played a show in Kelowna last year. Said, pick it up, Joel. We're dying in here. Picture one hand clapping, then picture half that sound. There's a reason that I hate that town. If you saw my band in the early days, then you understand. Davey and me, face down in our suit, some French restaurant. I saw Riviera de Loup last night at a tour. We burnt the place to the ground. There's a reason that I love this town. There's a reason that I love this town. There's a reason that I love this town.
That's another Kaufman show in the books. I'm Dave Kaufman. We'll be back next week.
I don't know.